You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Program. More about me at carlfrisch.com. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H.com. You know, I was following on Twitter, I'm sure you remember Campbell Brown, the former CNN anchor. What you might not know is that her husband is an advisor to Mitt Romney, and he also works with Michelle Rhee to tear apart unions and reform the way our schools are operating at the expense of teachers. And Crooks and Liars has this piece up, and I just want to read briefly so that we can set up the next guest. So basically Campbell Brown had an op-ed that was in the Wall Street Journal in which she attacked the American Federation for Teachers and said that they were coddling folks that assault children and sexual perverts and whatnot. She failed. This happens a lot in the media, by the way. Campbell Brown did not mention in her op-ed that her husband is an advisor to Michelle Rhee at Students First, which is a big enemy of unions, mischaracterizing what unions are there to do and the importance of good, strong teachers and regulations that make sure that teachers have what they need to do their jobs. So she didn't mention that. What she also didn't mention, there's this post by Caroli at Crooks and Liars, and she goes into some detail about the allegations back and forth. And how unfortunate it is that somebody like Campbell Brown, who purports herself to be a good journalist, would try and tar and feather the American Federation for Teachers by saying that they coddle basically child molesters, using maybe one or a handful of incidents to tarnish an entire union. And then she says what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and points out that not only does Campbell Brown's husband work for Michelle Rhee at Students First, but Michelle Rhee is married to Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento, who ran a charter school, was investigated by the Department of Justice, and in this big investigator general report, it turns out he may have been involved in the sexual assault of a 16-year-old girl. And Caroli basically points out, you wouldn't hold Kevin Johnson up to be the standard at which Michelle Rhee holds herself, and you shouldn't hold the actions of maybe a handful of teachers to stand for the entire union. All of this is to say that the American Federation of Teachers is really shaking up the way that people think about unions. And they had their international convention recently, and joining me now to talk about what they discussed there and what exactly solution-driven unionism is the American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten. Randy, thanks for joining me. Randy? Can you hear me? All right, we'll figure that out and get her back on the phone. But essentially, so Randy was speaking at the AFT convention in Detroit as the keynote, of course, because, where would the president speak? This new reality, this new normal, demands an entirely new approach to unionism, an approach that is relevant and appropriate to the 21st century. More than ever, we need to act in innovation, creative and new ways, simultaneously refuting our critics, advancing our values, connecting with community, and proposing solutions. That is solution-driven unionism. And I think we've got her now. Randy, are you there? Hey there.
I'm here. So, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So you had a big convention out in Michigan, and right. You're just back from that. And you gave the keynote and talked a lot about solution-driven unionism. What did you mean by that?
So let me just say, I heard the top of your hour. Let me just say that we are as vigilant about making sure we protect kids as everything else that we do.
Right.
And it was just, I just want, because part of what Campbell Brown was trying to do was to scare parents. And I just want you to know that the UFT contract, I've not actually seen a contract around the country like the UFT contract which was negotiated in 2005, that says if someone is convicted, if a teacher is convicted of any kind of sexual misconduct, they are to be automatically terminated. We do protect against false accusations.
Well, and that's the problem.
I just wanted to assure your listening audience that this is something that we are vigilant about. We love kids. We want to help kids. And we want to make sure that kids are safe.
And that's the problem with the way that Campbell, it's the problem with the way that Campbell Brown presented everything. I mean, she just didn't get the facts out there, not only on that front, but not letting people know that she might have a vested interest in attacking the AFT because her husband is employed by an interest that opposes the work that the AFT does.
Right. And frankly, you know, you may say that you don't like a decision that an arbitrator has done. You know, there's plenty of decisions that arbitrators have done that I don't like either. But you have to actually get the facts out about how much our local union, the UFT, and how much our national union have done to try, when we see something that doesn't work, to try to make things work. And that's why in 2005, when we saw some of these cases, we said, we want to make it crystal clear in the contract that if there, because, you know, look, there are bad people all over the place. And the UFT, there's 100,000 educators in New York City, of which most of them are amazing.
Right.
But, you know, there are bad doctors, there are bad police officers,
there's bad non-union teachers, there's
radio journalists, there are bad people. But we wanted to make sure crystal clear that if someone is convicted of sexual misconduct with children, automatic termination. I just wanted, you know, because part of what's happened this week, I don't normally talk about this, but I don't want parents to be scared that those of us that are in positions of responsibility are not taking our responsibility seriously in terms of making sure the kids are safe. Sorry.
Well, I admire your passion on the subject, because that's exactly what the other side is trying to do. They're trying to scare people, and they're trying to intimidate people to get their own way with the way that schools are working. They want to... They want to remove the power of unions to negotiate contracts. Which is, you know, I don't talk a lot about it, but my father was original founding secretary of ALADS, the Association of Los Angeles County Deputy Sheriffs. And my family would not have had a middle class existence if it wasn't for that union. He had sheriffs going through his garbage when he and his buddies were setting up the union. And eventually one of the county supervisors told the sheriff to knock it off, and then the union came in. But, you know, people need to it's good to give lip service when we talk about how much we admire our police and our firefighters and our troops and our teachers and our nurses. But if you don't stand up for their right to collectively bargain and get good, fair contracts that allow them to live a decent life, then you're really not standing up for them at all.
And that's what, you know, what unions, you know, when unions had their heyday, and part of what we want to do is try to get back to that, but when unions had their heyday, when people bargained contracts, they then set the standard of wages for the community. So if there was a contract that was bargained in like in a Ford plant, for example, for manufacturing, that actually would mean that all these other people who worked in manufacturing in the same community would get the same kind of wages. We were able, when we were a third of working people, to lift up the standard of living for everybody. And unfortunately, what's happened is that as in the private sector, as the union movement has gone from 35-38% of working families or working folk to 7% or 8%, wage inequality, the difference between wages earned by the rich and the poor, has grown by 40%.
It's sickening. Randy, can you stick around for a bit? I want to talk to you about the convention. We're talking to Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll have more with Randy after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll talk about solutions-based unionism after this. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Randy Weingarten. She is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. More about them at AFT.com. You can follow Randy on Twitter at rweingarten, and also the AFT at AFT Union. Randy, thanks for sticking around.
It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So you gave your keynote at the AFT convention in Detroit this past week, and you talked about solutions-based unionism. What does that mean?
So solution-driven unionism is a way for us to confront, you know, the new realities, not only of our workforce, but of America in general. That, you know, there is a new normal where, you know, whether it is because of the austerity budgets or whether it is because this constant drumbeat to try to divide those we serve from other people in the community. We need to be out there focused not just on fairness for our own members, which is what the union movement was always about, trying to create some, you know, dignity and respect and fairness. We have to be out there about making sure that the quality of the services we deliver are fantastic and that we actually unite those we represent and those we serve. We have to be solution-driven. We have to solve problems. We have to take the steps that, you know, others in civic leadership should have been taking, but they have not. And instead, you know, things have gotten very, very toxic. So I said to our, you know, to the assembled delegates, all of whom try to make a difference every single day in the lives of people, I said, yes, of course we should be refuting our critics and talking about why some of the things they talk about don't work. But we have to be advancing our values about how important public education is, how important economic opportunity is, how important democracy and fairness is. So we can't just refute our critics. We have to advance our values. We have to connect with communities. And we have to be out there proposing and doing what we can to make things happen in America. And so whether it means turning around a school and working with administrators and parents to turn it around so that it's good for kids, whether it means making sure that our evaluation systems in schools are the best they can be, making sure that we're fighting to get kids art and music and the kinds of subjects that really work for them, making sure we have, you know, services around schools so that, you know, so that kids who need mental health services or health care services or early childhood, we fight for those things as well. Making sure that our building trades colleagues have jobs by investing our pension monies in infrastructure and in job development. That's what I mean by solution driven, so that we're helping not only our own families, but all the families in America, all the families and communities.
Well,
not only the students in our classrooms, but all students.
Well, and towards that end, while you were in Michigan, the AFT partnered with a bunch of Michigan educators to deliver 500,000 books to kids there and around the nation as part of the first book program. Are those the types of things you mean when you talk about the way that the AFT and the locals can be a better part of the community?
First book is one of the examples. We know that kids really need books at home to read. That if we want to create a love of learning and a love of reading, kids need to have books. So we've partnered with this organization called First Books, who have actually delivered 90 million books to people in America, to particularly to disadvantaged kids in America. And we said, let's do this more, and let's connect it to actually the love and the learning of reading.
Well, and I assume
one of those issues. The other one we do is take what we're doing in McDowell County, the eighth poorest county in all of America. We said, let's actually not just help make the school system better, because we know that everything is interconnected. So let's work on making sure that there's jobs in the community, there's broadband in the community, there's housing in the community, there's social services in the community. That's what we mean by solution-driven unionism.
Well, and, you know, you talk about the first read program or first book program. I'm assuming that Fox News probably thinks you handed out 500,000 copies of the Communist Manifesto. Which brings me to...
You know, I have actually no idea what, you know, what tends to happen with Fox News is that when they can't criticize us, they just don't cover us.
Right. Well, Speaking of critics, I mean, you've got these huge corporations spending hundreds of millions of dollars against the unions. I mean, it made perfect sense to me after Citizens United when they said, okay, corporations and unions can now spend whatever they want to. Meanwhile, unions have always been, for the better part of 100 years, have had to basically tell the government and release to the public every penny of how they spend their money. Now corporations are hiding how they're spending their money politically, and the first target has been unions, to wipe them out so they can get complete control over the political system. How is AFT responding to that?
Well, look, we believe in people power. But what happens is that, people should be the voice of democracy. And when you have people like Mitt Romney that believe that corporations are people and that have unlimited amounts of money that they can use to change a debate, they can use to launch a diatribe, whether it's true or not, they can actually, create myths, be an evidence-free zone. You can't fight that, effectively, without getting money out of this amount of money out of this.
It's sick, and I know that the AFT is doing everything it can to get its message out.
Right.
You can find more about Randy Weingarten and the American Federation for Teachers at AFT.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch all afternoon. Stick around. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking to author Dean Koontz about his new book.
Yesterday was Thursday, Thursday. Today it is Friday. We so excited.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm not sure exactly why Shane O played a cover of one of the worst songs of all time, called Friday, by a young woman named, I think, Samantha Black or something like that. Anyways, it's a big show today. Filling in for Tom Hartman, I'm Carl Frisch. Joining us to talk about his new book, Odd Apocalypse, is author, best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author, Dean Koontz. Dean, thanks for joining us. Dean, are you there? Hello? All right, we're having some trouble with the boards, but we'll get to him in just a second. He's got a new book out. It's called Odd Apocalypse, and it's the fifth in the series about the Odd Thomas character. He's a young man who, about 20, who can communicate with the dead, and he can talk to them, but they can't talk to him. He can read their lips and figure out their hand sounds, but hand signs and whatnot. But it certainly sets up for some interesting back and forth. Dean, are you there? All right, I'm not sure what's going on with that, but are you there, Mr. Koontz? All right. You can find more about this book and the series on Dean's website at deankoontz.com. He's also on Facebook and whatnot. The basic premise of the book is his character is at a retreat and has a vision of a woman, a dead woman in a white nightgown on horseback, and then he's basically setting off to try and avenge her death. Dean, are you there?
I think I am, yeah.
All right, I think there were some unearthly spirits interfering with the connection.
It did seem a little spooky, didn't it? Yeah.
So how was I doing on explaining the premise of the latest in the Odd Thomas series?
I could sort of hear you at times and not at times, so I'm going to give you the benefit of doubt and say you did a perfect job.
So yeah, this is the fifth in the series, although there's also some graphic novels and a three-part ebook. Odd Thomas finds himself at the Roseland, kind of this compound resort kind of thing. He's off to avenge a woman's death, right?
Well, he finds himself, what it really is my take on Odd Thomas going through a Sunset Boulevard kind of scenario. It's an old estate in Montecito built by one of the first movie moguls. And when Odd ends up there, everything looks perfect. Every landscaping is pristine. Everything looks ideal. But because he has certain powers that other fry cooks don't, he's a fry cook by trade. He knows that there's something going on there that's very dark and very strange, and then it becomes an Odd Thomas adventure. Of course, if there wasn't something dark and strange, then there wouldn't be any point to the book.
Well, I got to tell you, I would pay good money to see a contestant on Top Chef with Odd Thomas's unique gifts. How does an author like you come to the determination that, okay, he's going to be able to communicate with those that have departed, but they won't be able to talk to him?
You know, the way this book came to me was particularly strange. I was working on another novel when I was halfway through it, and into my head came the line, Odd Thomas, my name is Odd Thomas, I lead an unusual life. It had nothing to do with what I was writing, so I knew it was the start of something else. It was a very Shirley MacLaine moment sort of beamed into the head. And I turned to write it down on a line tablet, and the next thing I knew I was writing longhand the whole first chapter. I've never done it before since. And those little details, which sort of what we would call the rules of the game, just sort of became, they wrote themselves. It's like, I think it's what psychologists call being in a flow state, or athletes call being in the zone. It just kind of takes care of itself. So when he said, the dead don't talk, I don't know why, I said, okay, let's go with that.
Well, and it's certainly turned into quite the series of books. This latest one people can find at your website, deankuntz.com. It's Odd Apocalypse. Do you envision more in the series?
I knew right away there were going to be more than one or two books, but I didn't know how many. Now I think there are going to be seven. I'm working on a book called Deeply Odd right now. And he's on a journey, and he's got a promise to fulfill. And when that promise gets fulfilled to him, the story will end, which will be sad for me because this guy is sort of like somebody I know in real life.
Right.
When I'm writing the book, I can hear his voice in my head, and he makes me laugh out loud. So people outside my office door think I should be institutionalized, sitting alone laughing.
Well, only if you reply back to him. But I suppose it would have been more difficult to name this series if his name was Tim or Albert.
Oh, absolutely, and that's why I'm glad it came out. You know, Tim Apocalypse wouldn't really work very well.
Now, before I let you go, I do have a question that we're decidedly left of center. Political talk radio show here. I'm curious. I noticed I wasn't sure about your politics, but I Googled you and I noticed that you gave money to Michelle Bachmann. And I'm curious if it's because she's like a fictional character that says stuff that you just can't make up, and you're using her as like a research piece for an upcoming book. I'm reminded of her like little hunt for, maybe she's talking to people that have moved on in this Muslim Brotherhood crusade against Hillary Clinton. Or is it something else?
Well, it's basically, I like outsiders. I write about outsiders, in all my books. My books often have disabled people in them because we work with charities for the disabled. And I realized one day that they never appear in fiction. Somebody who's a paraplegic or a quadriplegic or somebody with spina bifida, the only fiction they appear in is fiction that, is all about their disability. So I've for years thought, wow, this is new and different material. So I'm given to outsiders, people who don't think like everybody else and think outside the box. And it doesn't much matter to me. The biggest thing is about how they think outside the box, or rather that they do, not that they necessarily, Odd doesn't always agree with everybody. Odd is an equal opportunity offender in his novel.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk with us about the book. People can find it and your other work at deankuntz.com. I've just started reading this latest installment, and I'm quite enjoying it thus far, Mr. Kuntz. So I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me there.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Bye.
I think that was Dean Kuntz saying that he gave money to Michelle Bachmann and then likening the reason because he's drawn to people that are handicapped. All right. Well, the book is pretty good. I'm reading it. It's pretty funny. The character is charming and pretty funny. Take what you will from that. it's been a big day or long week in terms of what's going on out there. You've got any day now we're expecting Mitt Romney to announce his running mate. You know, next week is the last week before he kicks off a 2-week bus tour across the country, leading up to the Republican National Convention. And again, how great is the Republican National Convention? I mean, just think about it. August, Tampa, Mitt Romney. I mean, what a great combination. I can think of nothing worse than that. But we're also taking your calls, toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Are you looking forward to the Republican Convention? I know I am. All right, let's talk to John in Walden, New Jersey. Hey, John. All right, we're having some problems with the board, and we're gonna get it straightened out. But are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hey, John.
Actually, it's Sean.
All righty. Hey, Sean, what's going on?
And I'm in Walden, New York. I've just called to remind you and other people that today is actually the 31st anniversary of the day that Ronald Reagan took his first shot against American labor and the middle class.
Right, with the air traffic controllers.
And PACO. Right.
Right.
I mean, all what he did was react in kind to what we did was react in kind to his illegal labor negotiations.
Yeah,
we did.
They've known for a long time. Republicans and business interests have known for a long time that the only way they can go back on 150 years of progress in this country so that we can have child labor again and no work standards and everything else is one of two things: destroying the labor movement and at the same time shipping industrial and manufacturing jobs overseas to countries where they can get that kind of labor. Until we need jobs so bad in this country that we're willing to do those things that we eschewed 100 years ago. It is the anniversary. And you know what's sick about it? You've got Daryl Issa in Congress. He's the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, who was, you know, into petty theft when he was growing up, burglarizing cars. And, he wants to name coastal waters off of the United States after Ronald Reagan. I mean, it is one thing to name high schools and roads and bridges after our former presidents. We've been doing that a long time. You can ask.
They named an airport after Ronald Reagan.
Oh,
fire the controllers.
The only, you know, most of the city does not call it Reagan National. We all call it Washington National too. But it's one thing to name something after Lincoln or Eisenhower or Kennedy. You know, Lincoln healed the nation. Kennedy inspired a generation of scientists, and Eisenhower built the friggin' interstate highway system. But to name something after Reagan, I think the only thing, they should leave the fish the ocean, and they can name the unemployment offices after Reagan. Well, this is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, we'll talk more about Daryl Issa's move to name the oceans after Reagan. Seriously, can't make this up. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch. It is Friday. We're taking your calls. 866-987-TOM, 866-987-8466. Conservatives, move right to the front of the line. Don't want you to feel like we're leaving you on hold too long. Let's talk to Bob in Northville, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, how you doing, Carl?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good, pretty good. I got a couple questions, but first I want to find out, how can we listen to you when you're not subbing for Tom?
Unless you're bugging my my apartment or my office, I think it'd be very difficult. Every Thursday morning, I'm on the Stephanie Miller Show at about 9 o'clock Eastern Time,
okay.
So you can hear me there. And otherwise, stay tuned. You can go to my website, carlfrisch.com, sign up for email updates, and I'll let you know through email, Facebook, and Twitter when I'm on other programs.
Okay. My first question is. did you quit working for John McCain because he gave up the straight talk? Or did McCain give up the straight talk because you quit working for him?
Well, I don't think he ever did have straight talk. I think if you look at his record going back, and for people that don't know, yes, in a former life I experimented with Republicanism. I think if you look at his record, he's always been conservative. He was just really adept at picking issues that were wildly popular with the American people to latch himself onto. And the media has a fetish for campaign finance reform, except recently when it deals with the corporations that own their systems, their companies. You know, it was 2000, and I was almost ready to leave the party anyways. I happened to be in South Carolina helping out the campaign. I did several states for McCain. And remember, in 2000, McCain was supposedly the moderate candidate for president against George W. Bush in the Republican primary. And I'm sitting in this office in Columbia, South Carolina, and sharing the office space. It was the office space given to the campaign by the Quinns, their, you know, political royalty in terms of the consulting class in South Carolina. And they published out of the same building a magazine called Southern Partisan Magazine, which is a virulently racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic magazine that sells Confederate memorabilia in the back. I'm surprised it doesn't sell white burning crosses. It's just racist beyond belief. And it was then that I knew, not to mention all the, you know, anti-gay, misogynistic, anti-Semitic things I heard from other people working on the campaign. It was then that I knew that if this was the moderate in the Republican field, there was no room for me in the party. And, you know, when I came out and when I switched parties, I began to more identify with people who, had not been done right by the government. And, it made me more progressive as a result.
Well, that was my second question. Was McCain really a straight talker, or did he just seem that way compared to all the Republican liars?
You know, Paul Waldman and David Brock wrote a great book called, what the heck was it called? It was about John McCain and the 2012 election. I think it was called, Straight Talk or something like that. And it delved into McCain's career, and how the media had built up this aura of McCain, and how it was all a bunch of baloney, that he'd always been conservative, that the media was in the tank for him. And it does a good job of explaining his record, and not just that, but also shattering the myth of John McCain. John McCain never really changed. It was called Free Ride, John McCain and the Media by David Brock and Paul Waldman. I would suggest if you go to Amazon, you can pick up a copy. And it'll tell you far more than we have time to on today's show. But I want to thank you for calling in, Bob. Thanks. And let's go to Jeff in Manassas, Virginia. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. We've only got a few minutes. What's up?
I wonder about Mitt's tax returns and his tax issues. I think the Democrats play way too nice.
Really? You think we play too nice? I always put it in perspective for people this way, as a former Republican. When a Republican shows up at a knife fight, they stab you in the stomach, they watch you fall to the ground, they put their foot on your neck, break your neck, and then walk away smiling that a job has been well done. When a Democrat does it, they give you a flesh wound, they give you a Band-Aid, they help you into the ambulance, they give you their insurance card, they go with you, they send flowers. And that's the difference. If we were Republicans right now, we'd be running ads that claim, the reason he's not released his taxes is because he's in bed with Gaddafi, that he gave money to terrorist sympathy groups.
Or that he didn't pay taxes at all. And I think that,
which is actually probably the most mellow thing you could say, and it's probably true for a lot of the years.
Yeah, I mean, you know that there's something in there. If there wasn't anything in there, there's no way he would take this kind of political fire.
You know who is in there?
So easily.
You know, well, that's probably true. You know who knows what's in there is John McCain. He's seen 23 years, and we haven't even seen a full year. Remember, when a Republican tells you that he's already released his taxes, you tell them he only released 1 year and he didn't even release the full tax return. We don't know where those missing documents about the Swiss bank accounts and the accounts in the Grand Cayman Islands are, because he didn't include the right paperwork. So let's hit one more. Barry in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Barry.
Yes, Carl Frisch. Hello, sir.
Hey.
I listen to Tom as much as I can, and I'm homeless myself. But one thing was brought up. One thing I ran into one time the people's budget. The lady that was on about the education earlier?
Randy Weingarten from the American Federation of Teachers.
Yes. All her troubles would be solved, and so many other people, their troubles would be solved. The people's budget put together by the progressive group.
The Progressive Caucus in Congress.
In Congress, yes. Now, that hasn't been brought to the table, and I wonder why and how is it?
Well, it hasn't been brought to the table because Democrats don't control the majority in Congress, and you're not going to be able to bring anything to the table when you're in the minority. That's why people need to go out and fight and help elect more progressives to Congress. The Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in Congress, but it doesn't make up a majority in the House. And the only way that budget will ever see the light of day is if we elect more progressives into Congress and take back the majority from Speaker Boehner and Eric Cantor. And let's remember, it's really Eric Cantor who's running the show there. So if we want any hope, we've got to get rid of them and bring in some new leadership, make Nancy Pelosi Speaker again, and get that budget voted on. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom all afternoon, I'm Carl Frisch. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk to Michael Calderon from Huffington Post about the gaffes of plenty media and how it's causing the candidates to be more scripted.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. All afternoon, filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch, Democratic strategist, syndicated columnist. More about me at carlfrisch.com, where you can connect with me on Twitter, Facebook, and all the other social networking websites. Feel free to stalk me at will. It's been a good afternoon thus far. We were talking a little bit about the gaffes this week that the Mitt Romney campaign experienced abroad. And I was drawn to this piece by Michael Calderon from Huffington Post, who talks about the fact that the media's endless obsession with gaffes is potentially leading to candidates running for president that are less open to, freewheeling conversations with the media. In the piece, he writes, whether at home or abroad, presidential candidates' so-called gaffes and the media's preoccupation with each inartfully phrased or impolitic remark have defined the 2012 election. Gaffes get tweeted, blogged, and reported. Cable pundits declare them game changers, and rival campaigns amplify them through any means possible. When that's done, the story becomes whether the campaign gaffed in cleaning or is cleaning up the gaffe. It's true. It's pretty similar to what the rest of the media's attention usually is, and it's not typically about the issues. It's about the inner workings of campaigns, which, as we all know, is really interesting to people that live inside the Beltway, but doesn't capture the attention of many people outside of it. Joining me now to talk about his piece at Huffington Post is Michael Calderon. He's a senior media reporter at Huffington Post. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Carl. How's it going?
Good. So this piece is really well done, and I think you nail a lot of the different pieces. In terms of, talking about how gaffes have not just shaped the 2012 election, but politics in general, so that candidates are more scripted, they're more closed off to the media. I think people were surprised in 2008 that John McCain was so guarded from the media. I worked for McCain in 2000. I can tell you that reporters gave him a lot of space in terms of gaffes because of how open he was in that campaign cycle. And then 2008 changed entirely. He was not nearly as open, and that was one of the things that reporters talked about. How different do you think it is in 2012?
Right. I mean, you make a really great point. And for this piece, my colleague and I, Sam Stein, spoke with Steve Schmidt, obviously
right.
with experience in the 2000 and 2008 McCain campaigns. And, what you said makes sense. When reporters have 2 hours with a candidate, sort of freewheeling discussion, they often give, they give a bit more rope to the candidate. They let them go back if they've said something inartful, if they've, used poor grammar, if they said something that doesn't quite make sense. You give them a bit more of a chance to kind of go back. But, at this point in time where there's really scarce amount of time that reporters, especially traveling press with Romney, it was apparent on this 6-day trip where they only got 3 questions, but also the Obama campaign. Obama similarly doesn't take the sort of unscripted questions on a rope line from reporters either and doesn't mix it up with them that much as well. So you don't have a lot of time with these candidates, and you know, oftentimes any little remark, anything that's said out of context can be picked up immediately.
Well, and how much of that has to do with the fact that they're covering the gaffe, or that they're just covering whatever's happening day to day in a campaign to begin with? I mean, we focus so much inside the Beltway on talking about the day to day dynamics of a campaign than we do about the issues that the candidates are pushing. Candidates could roll out their big health care plans or whatever, and we're going to focus on the politics of the plan as opposed to what's in the plan as a media.
Right. I mean, this happens every day. And like, for instance, today with the job numbers, you see this every single month in an election year. The job numbers are reported, whether it's good for Obama or good for Romney, bad for Obama, bad for Romney, versus the larger issue of, millions of people unemployed.
Right.
I mean, this happens every single month. And today in particular, you had both sides spinning it the best way they could. You know, both the job gains, but then also the rising unemployment number. So you see this with issues time and time again, especially in an election year. It's even worse. And political reporters really do focus tremendously on the inner workings of campaigns and what are often referred to as process stories. I think I read about three stories already today on the traveling press secretary for the Romney campaign who snapped at reporters and is now taking a week off. I saw ABC News covered this.
I think it could be the first time in history of political campaigns that somebody is taking time off for exhaustion that isn't a Lohan or a Kardashian.
So his, a single staffer's week off, you know, immediately becomes a story because reporters are obsessed with covering the process of campaigns.
Well, and is it obsession or is it the way things are because of these two reasons? One, the people covering, you know, I remember in 2000 being on the campaign trail in all the early primary states and being surrounded by people I'd read for years covering presidential politics, whether it was Peter Goldman from Newsweek, who'd covered campaigns back to Bobby Kennedy, and people like him that were still traveling, Gehrmand, traveling with these campaigns. And now you've got what amounts to, and I'm not saying that there are not experienced people on the trail, but there are a lot younger people who have not necessarily, had the experience of doing multiple campaigns over and over again covering these races. And they certainly don't have the depth of knowledge when it comes to policy. And too often newspapers also don't have the resources in terms of research to give them the depth of policy they might need. So what's a campaign to do? Focus on the stuff that their friends talk about, the inner workings of campaigns.
You know, it's interesting. I spent a few days with the Romney campaign traveling with the press corps, and it, for the most part, it is a very young press corps. A lot of the reporters there are network embeds, young producers in their early 20s, and they're the ones who are capturing every single moment of the campaign. They're basically tweeting every other line that Romney says.
And why would a 40-year-old reporter who's being paid less than they've ever been paid want to go on the road for a year and a half with a candidate and miss their family?
Right. Well, I mean, you have mostly young people covering this, and this is not to take away from their talent at all.
Oh, of course
not. You lose that sort of institutional memory. I mean, I even and in my early 30s, but I felt a bit old around some of the press, some of the reporters when I was traveling around on the campaign trail, because even that 10 years is a long time in politics.
Well, it's also a product of what is expected of reporters. You know, in 2004, when the Dean campaign was talking about bloggers, reporters would write things like in their pajamas in their parents' basement. Now reporters all have blogs. And they're expected to blog every time something happens without having the time to go get what the bigger picture is. So stories develop in more of a 5-minute news cycle than they do in a 24-hour news cycle even.
The amount that reporters are filing is just incredible. When you take into account how many tweets they're producing from the road and how many of those tweets then turn into blog items and then how many then turn into fully fledged reports, as well as, you know, the network producers who are taking all this film every day and how much of this material is ending up on the web and then how much of it gets into the evening newscast. They're filing constantly from the bus. You know, in my brief few days on the Romney bus, every single stop, people then would get on the bus and basically be filing their next piece rather than taking in a lot of
what's happening
and done. And you would see Romney would make, any sort of little interaction reporters had with him would immediately become a story.
Well, you know, in my day, Michael, in 2000,
like old men here.
I know, right? I'm 34 for the record. But in my day, in 2000, and even a bit 2004, you'd have breaks in the campaign day for filing. And you might get two of them if you were a lucky reporter, because there was no, like, traveling Wi-Fi. You couldn't file a story from your cell phone. They'd rent these giant rooms with telephone connections so that people could either read their stories back to the newsroom or connect to a decent internet connection to send them in. And as a result, you got longer reporting with more time for a reporter to sit and ruminate on a subject than, gosh, I better get it in time. Do you have a second to stick around and talk a little bit more about this?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to.
All right. That's Michael Calderon. He is the senior media reporter for Huffington Post. We're talking about the gas-supplying nature of the media and why that might be here to stay. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we'll try and explain why you don't like political reporting.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. If you're just joining us, I'm filling in for Tom all afternoon. Carl Frisch here. We've been chatting with Michael Calderon. He is the senior media reporter for the Huffington Post. And we've been talking a bit about why the media obsesses on these gaffes and just how bad it makes political reporting in general. Michael, it occurred to me during the break that this is not a symptom that only political reporters suffer. It happens in the media. You're a media reporter. I mean, how much time have you spent watching cable news, network news, even entertainment industry folks doing navel-gazing where they're covering themselves?
Right. You get that sort of meta coverage in various different areas as well as political reporting. I, as a media reporter who covers the media and work in media, it's hard for me to criticize navel gazing by and large. But you know, I think it's a little bit different in political reporting. I recently spoke with Matt Bye from the New York Times,
yeah,
and about this issue for another piece, and one of his things was, you know, he's obsessed with the New York Yankees. He'll read any sort of inconsequential coverage of the New York Yankees, even if they have an off day. He'll read, you know, all the blogs about the New York Yankees. And his thing was, you know, inside baseball coverage is not necessarily a bad thing. The difference with politics is that politics is something actually really important.
Right. The difference between the Kardashians, 72-day divorce and the healthcare reform bill is that one actually impacts your life.
Yeah, one actually matters to a lot of people, and one is stuff that you can be engaged in and really love the minutiae of celebrity news and sports news, but it's not going to be actually impacting people in a significant way.
So how does this get changed? I mean, aside from consumers saying, enough, we're not reading your newspaper, we're really not going to read it now.
Well, I think political reporters, similar to the herd mentality that was in decades past, they tend to focus on the same thing. You know, when you're out with these with the press corps, whether it's people covering Romney or Obama or other candidates, many of them tend to tell the same story. If something happens in an event, everybody feels obliged to cover that same moment. And maybe if there's some reporters covering with a more counterintuitive take on what happened,
sure,
or covering things in a different way, if that's seen as a viable alternative, then people will go to that.
Well, I remember during the 2008 primaries when Howard Dean was about to lose in Iowa, and Judy Dean came out for the first campaign trip she'd ever done for Howard Dean, his wife. And the campaign had given an exclusive on the story with the ability to ask a couple questions of Judy Dean to the reporter who was traveling from the Burlington Free Press. And I remember when Judy Dean and Howard Dean came on the bus, and all the reporters were agaga, you know, they wanted to ask questions on the record, but it was an off-the-record thing, and everybody was getting angry and wanting to put it on the record. And then the Burlington Free Press guy, who at this point had an exclusive opportunity to chat with Judy Dean, started arguing with the campaign as well, that everybody should have an opportunity to chat with her. And I was just thinking, like, hey, buddy, you should call your editor and tell him you have an exclusive, rather than trying to, you know, get, you know, give up what you've managed to pull down from the campaign so that everybody else can have it. That was an example, though, of a small town paper that just happens to be the biggest paper in a very small state, sending somebody on the road for something that they'd never done before. They'd never had a reporter cover a presidential campaign. I guess my concern is that the media will begin to get complacent with the way things are, with the status quo, that mm-hmm. the lack of access will not lead to any effort in the media to open access other than the occasional, oh, we haven't heard him on a, you know, Mitt Romney on a Sunday show in 110 days, or Mitt Romney hasn't answered these questions or those questions. Do you think that reporters are likely to just take what it is and move on and let this become the status quo?
You know, a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times reported on a pretty common practice in covering this
right.
election, which is the campaigns basically giving no access. They would speak on background to reporters, and then reporters would come back to them and say, can I use these quotes on the record? And they would basically tailor the quotes however they wanted and cut out everything that didn't fit their message that day. And that's pretty common, actually, in political reporting. And
in
the
all
New York
reporting.
Times highlighted it. And, you know, a lot of news organizations came out and said, we're not going to keep doing this practice. We're not going to give all this power to the campaigns. But, you know, we'll see how that actually plays out. Still, by and large, the campaigns can dictate who they want to talk to. If they don't want to talk to a certain number, certain reporters covering them, they may prefer a more sympathetic outlet to give an interview to. And then that outlet will be covered, and Romney perhaps might give a conservative blogger an interview. And that interview will then be covered by all the mainstream media anyway. So the campaigns wield a lot of power, and it's the reporters should press them to do more on the record, to do more press availabilities, but, you know, I'm reluctant to say whether anything will change overnight.
And when they do get those opportunities to sit down with reporters, how important do reporters think it is to maintain the relationship there by not asking tough follow-up questions to answers so that they don't get shunned and don't have an opportunity to get access again?
There is a big difference between being a beat reporter and being able to kind of swoop in and cover a candidate. The beat reporters, some of these network embeds have been with Romney for, I don't know, well over a year and several months. And when you're covering a beat, you're very much dependent upon access. And if you feel like you're going to lose your access, reporters often will, you know, may self-censor. You know, if you're coming in and you don't depend on them for access for today, you're just writing one magazine piece, you may ask the tougher questions, and you may ask things that a normal beat reporter wouldn't.
It certainly makes me wish that everybody was coming in for just a day to cover a campaign. Michael Calderon, senior media reporter from Huffington Post. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we will be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking to Art Levine from the Washington Monthly.
So glad today is Friday. I've got 48 hours.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. On this Friday afternoon, 34 after, filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com, where you can follow me on Twitter, connect with me on Facebook, and much, much more. We're taking your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Let's go to Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. I actually wanted to make a comment as a political reporter. I blog for Huffington Post and Daily
sure.
Coast and reporter for Pacifica Radio. And you know, there's some issues that you totally, totally put your finger on there that it's really been bothering a lot of journalists. And when you said that the media tends to cover the the political strategy behind the campaigns rather than the policy questions.
Sure.
I find that it's always been the case, especially during presidential elections, but this year...
Well, precisely during presidential elections, because other campaigns tend to get very little coverage whatsoever in general.
Yeah, and my situation as a journalist myself is that I'm surrounded by people who really, I think, believe that the most important thing is to bring hits to the website and
yeah.
to attract advertising. And that's why a lot of people are jumping on the bandwagon. And I have to say that, you know, the Huffington Post has done a great job at covering stories that no one else will cover. But that is rare, especially in the corporate media. And even in the alternative media, I've noticed that there's a tendency towards sort of talking head sort of punditry where,
right.
you know, there'll be a really alternative media program, and they really don't take much input from people on the streets. It's mostly like, well, here's a professor, or here's an expert, or here's an expert.
Well, I would like to hear from experts. Unfortunately, you usually don't hear from experts. I mean, if you watch primetime cable news, even Dayside, where they're, you know, doing more news reporting than actual, you know, opinion punditry. For example, when we were talking about the debt ceiling, there were, you could count the number of economists that were featured on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC on one hand that discussed the issue. You would not have been able to keep up with the number of pundits who discussed the issue. The same thing goes for healthcare. The number of healthcare experts that discussed healthcare reform during the debate in Washington over that issue, one hand again. They don't talk enough to experts. I wouldn't mind it if we talked to experts. If you want to talk about analysis of what's happening in Washington, I'd much rather it come from an expert who can tell us the ins and outs of what the policy would do than some pundit who's going to talk about the politics of it.
The other issue, too, is that a lot of newsrooms have been cut to the bone.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have as many reporters as we used to. And here in Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is completely online now. It was a joint ownership,
right.
joint partnership agreement there. But we're basically, you know, we're relying on a small group of reporters that are overworked and underpaid. They have really, really tight deadlines.
Well, they're not even just underpaid anymore. They're understaffed. To a degree, I mean, it used to be that a newsroom had research assistants and fact checkers and all kinds of things that helped make sure a story got out the door in a professional manner. That's not the case anymore. I remember hitting refresh on websites at midnight waiting for a story to post that I'd, you know, either been working on or whatever with a reporter for a boss. And now with reporters filing all throughout the day and the effort to always be the first, regardless of whether you're accurate, things have really slid downhill.
And that is a problem in the blog world, too, is that there are certain websites, and I won't mention them, but who seem to be more interested in getting the news first and not necessarily getting it right.
Right.
And there's a person named Ryan Halliday who wrote a book recently about all of this kind of thing, and he actually is one of those people who got paid professionally to try to get this information through the media, through movie companies, and
right.
they do the same thing in politics. But, you know, there really is a difference today, and that is that a lot of corporate editorial boards, and I've been to a few of these meetings, are really, really relying on social networking for free information and free sources. They're watching the bloggers. They have a website manager who's there 24 hours a day, maybe several of them, who are watching blogs, looking for something to pop up on the social networks that they don't necessarily have the staff to cover,
right.
but they will definitely take other people's stories and make that a major news story in a major newspaper or magazine or website. So,
well, that's become more and more
that situation.
That's become more and more prevalent in the media. You know, when I was working on Capitol Hill, if I had trouble getting a reporter to cover something, I'd go to the blogs. And this was in 2004, 2005, long before it was a standard practice. And now it's done, you know, every day, all day long. By people, you know, who really are overworked and underpaid. Let's go to, how about Angie in Mesa, Arizona? Hey, Angie.
Hi.
Hello. What's on
Hi,
your mind?
Carl. How are you?
Good, thanks.
This is a complicated one, but I have about as much compassion as I can have. You know, muster up for any human being or whatever. I'm a little frustrated because I can't get the right story. I don't know if you have children, but we do have mm-hmm. two children here in Arizona that I had to move them to different schools just for reasons of academics to get them a better education.
Okay.
School they were in dropped in performance, and I was told that, and there was a large population of Hispanics moving in, and that's fine. It's just that it started to make me feel like I was a little bit outnumbered and just socially a little bit awkward, but also a lot of the kids didn't speak English, so they had to teach, they call it, I think, ELL students,
right.
English language learning. And so it did take away, and I guess they don't check ID or there's no, I just worry we're setting up, I guess Obama said something, or I heard this was becoming a new thing to let anyone under 30 go ahead and stay in the country if they've been brought here as children.
Well, they have to. Hang on a second before you get that out there, which is not true.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know what is anymore.
Well, let's make sure we do know what it is before we say it on nationally syndicated radio, right?
Absolutely.
They have to have been here for 5 years, and they also have to be caught up on taxes and everything else. So
okay.
It's a little bit different than if you're under 30, you can stay.
Well, as long as they're paying taxes and contributing, and it's not taking away from me, and it's not encouraging.
It's not. And you know what? If we got rid of every undocumented immigrant in this country.
No, I don't say that.
I'm not saying you are, but there's more than just you on this phone call, right? There's people out there listening. If we did get rid of every undocumented immigrant in this country, the economy would collapse.
I don't know.
Well, I do.
I don't know all that. I just know it's
I do. You wouldn't be able to get food for cheap. You wouldn't be able to get most of the services that you require for what you're paying for them now.
Based on what would happen if. Let's just talk about what's happening right now to me. This is happening in my neighborhood, and I don't know what to do about it because we had to move to get a better education. I just want you to know that there are us people out here that are just doing nothing wrong. We've been here for, you know, generations, and also we're getting affected. I just hope middle class doesn't become the one to take the burden. I don't think it'll be the wealthy seem to get around everything, or the very wealthy, and the very poor seem to get around everything, and those would include some, of course, the migrants, too. But isn't there a legal way to do that, to come in, do all the things by the book? Why not do that?
Well, some people do that.
No, why not everyone do that?
Well, I don't know why everyone. I mean, it's not a simple solution, is it?
Yes, you can go to the border and cross it legally. Why isn't that simple?
It's not. You don't get to stay. I mean, the reason that people come.
You mean to be a jerk. I'm just saying, why is it that complicated?
I don't understand your question. I mean,
go to the border. If you want to come here, you get your card to work here. You do everything by the book, and I don't have a problem
with
it.
Lots of people do that.
You only have a problem if you illegally, or if you continue. Let's say they made mistakes in the past, but are we going to continue this process? It doesn't, spreading poverty will not cure poverty, nonetheless, either. I mean,
well, you know what?
I do not think Mexico is incapable of helping their people. All people should.
Did you want to talk the whole time, or am I going to get a word in?
I'm getting poorer. That's all I know. It's like.
Well, what I would say is that we're not going to solve this problem until we have comprehensive immigration reform. You know, there are people here that did not come here through legal means. It's actually going backwards if you look at the numbers now. There are people leaving this country that are undocumented as opposed to a net gain in this country. So. The reason people come here is the reason people have always come here, whether or not it's legal. They want jobs that they can get a better life for their families. And the only way that we're ever going to change the way that things are right now is if we bring people out of the dark and into the system. And the only way to do that is with comprehensive immigration reform. I feel bad for your family and the position that you think you're in. But you know, the very poor, the way you seem to make it out to be, they've got it taken care of, and the rich got it taken care of, and it's the people in the middle class hurting. I hate to break it to you, but the very poor have it pretty awful as well. So, you know, I don't have a solution to your problem, but I can tell you right now, that the solution to immigration and undocumented immigrants is comprehensive immigration reform, which Republicans have blocked at every turn. Let's get one more quick, question in before the break. Let's go to Tina in Cottonwood, Arizona. Hey, Tina.
Hi. I got a message on my answering machine from Bill Bennett from Focus on the Family yesterday.
Yes.
And they said they're sending me a commit to vote pack for 2012, including a voter registration, and I'm already registered Democrat. I don't know why they're sending me this stuff.
Well, here's what you should do. Anytime anybody out there gets a piece of direct mail from a right-wing cause or a right-wing organization, take the self-addressed stamped envelope, fill it with everything that came in the mailer, and send it back to them. That way, they have to pay for it. Every time they get one of those envelopes back in the mail, they have to pay for it. So if you send every piece back to them with what they sent you, you'll be costing them some more money, and it's one way to make them go under. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch all afternoon.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Connect to me on Facebook and Twitter and everything else. Let's go to Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Did I pronounce that right, Judy?
Yep, that's right.
Oh, well, there we go. So you work in immigration, and you want to set the last caller straight.
Right. I do, because immigration laws have not been overhauled since the mid-60s, so we have basically got a Cold War immigration policy with a few nasty tweaks in the mid-90s by the Gingrich Congress. The wait can literally be a lifetime long.
Right.
And what's happened in the 40, 50 years since the last revision of our immigration laws is that the world's changed a lot. NAFTA changed Mexican agricultural economy by having our subsidized grain collapse their corn market, and suddenly subsistence farmers who couldn't make a living. They used to get by just fine, but suddenly it was cheaper to buy American grain. So not only did our factory jobs go to Mexico, but our corn went there too, and it made people need to leave home. All things being equal, people would usually rather stay home. And they migrate for the same reasons that people have always migrated,
right.
Usually because they need to feed their families. Now, immigration at this point, you're quite right, has slowed to either zero or gone negative because things are a little better in Mexico now. And
well, it's a combination of three things, right? Jobs are not as plentiful here. Things are a little bit better in Mexico. And the Obama administration has done more of border enforcement than the Bush administration did in any regard.
Absolutely. He has done more to guard the borders and tighten up the borders than Bush ever dreamed of. So when they say he's done nothing, when right-wing people say that, they're not telling the truth.
Yeah, I really appreciate your call, Judy. I think it's important to remind our conservative friends, even our wayward liberal friends, that this president has done more on enforcement than his predecessor. Not the least of which is deporting more undocumented immigrants than Bush did in two terms. Let's go now to Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, with today's headlines. Hey, Victoria.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's happening out there?
Well, various things are going on. I'm sure you've talked about the jobs numbers, so
yes.
I just mentioned very briefly 163,000 jobs in July. Unemployment ticked up slightly to 8.3 from 8.2%. Also today, the UN General Assembly denounced the Syrian crackdown and criticized Security Council inaction. Before the vote, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon actually said that the fresh violence in the city of Aleppo needed reminding and drew comparisons between the failure to act in Syria with the international community's failure to protect people from past genocide in Srebrenica and Rwanda. Also today, House Democratic leaders offered a final set of talking points to their rank-and-file members before they leave for their five-week August recess, and they're urging them to highlight the summer's unfinished business, including the Farm Bill, reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, and Postal Service reform, all of which the Senate has approved with bipartisan support. And also, leaders want them to emphasize the distinction between their party's tax plan and that of the Republicans.
Well, I've seen some new information out this just today that some studies are saying that the Republican tax plan, the Mitt Romney plan, would raise taxes on 95% of Americans, versus the Obama and Democratic plan, which would only raise taxes on income over $250,000. You'd still get the tax cut for your first $250,000 in income, but it really only applies to the extremely affluent.
Wow. Wow. Well, I mean, it's a question of numbers, ultimately. It's, you know, it's a question of numbers and whether the numbers add up. And it just seems that the more people look at those numbers, the more they, in Romney's new tax plan, the more they just seem to be saying that those numbers don't add up. Mitt Romney addressed his taxes issue today. As you know, there's a whole he said, she said thing going on with Harry Reid, which
right.
is put up or shut up. Well, Romney said today, categorically, I've paid taxes every year and a lot of taxes, so Harry is wrong. Harry Reid really has to put up or shut up.
I don't believe Mitt Romney. unless he's willing to show us, I don't believe him. He's shown his ability to bald-faced lie to the American people. At this point, I don't believe it unless I see his taxes, because he still hasn't released his full taxes from last year.
Well, he was then asked, it's possible that he paid a lot of money, but not much of a percentage in taxes.
Right, that's true.
Then he was asked why he wouldn't release more years of tax returns to prove Reid wrong, and he dodged that. He said, you can go on our website and you can see my financial disclosure statements going back to 2002. You can also see our tax returns from 2010.
Which is a lie. It's not his entire tax return. It's missing forms about his Swiss bank accounts and his money in the Grand Caymans.
And he promised that when the 2011 tax returns are ready, they would also be released.
I'm guessing he has an extension until October?
Apparently there are an awful lot of bits and pieces to put together when you've got that much money.
It's the truth. It's very true. It looks like things are getting heated up for the summer. I'm hearing that we're expecting an announcement next week of who his vice presidential running mate's going to be just in time for his two-week road trip leading into the Republican convention.
That's the conventional wisdom. I mean, if I were advising him, I would advise him to do it, like, on Monday.
I would have advised him to do it from London to get people to stop talking about his gaffes.
Yeah, really. That was awkward. But it makes sense. He's got 2 or 3 weeks. August is, you know, a bit of a desert. The Olympics will be ending. He's got time. That's the time for people to get to know the nominee, the vice presidential nominee, to campaign, and really, from his point of view, more importantly, fundraise.
And then right into the Republican convention. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. And then in the next hour, we will be talking to Art Levin from the Washington Monthly about the real truth behind Bain, and we'll be talking to John Fugelsang, the comedian and actor, about his new show on Current Television and the 2012 elections. You won't want to miss it. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 6 minutes after the top of the hour. Filling in for Tom today, all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch, Democratic strategist, syndicated columnist. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Sign up for emails. Join me on Facebook and Twitter. We've heard a lot about Bain and Mitt Romney over the last several months. But what we haven't done much of, beyond talking about the jobs that Romney has ended or shifted overseas through Bain, is delve into what these companies that they've invested in, that they've purchased, that they've bought up, do. Some of these companies are not, let's just say, good eggs. Joining us to talk about one such example is Art Levin. He is a contributing editor of the Washington Monthly and a contributor to Salon, The Nation, The Atlantic, and many other publications, and he's got a great piece at Salon, which I encourage you all to check out at salon.com. It's called The Dark Side of a Bain Success. Art, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Carl. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Absolutely. So you tell the story of these adult addiction and teen behavioral problem facilities.
Right. They're two separate wings of a company called CRC Health Group.
And that company is owned by Bain Capital?
Absolutely. It was purchased in 2006 when it was just a drug treatment chain, and it was entered into by Bain, and this is after Romney had already left the company, but he...
Had he retroactively retired yet?
Well, he could have retroactively retired, but he certainly was a limited... There's no question in all the disputes about when he actually left and what his real function was. He was a limited partner in a fund called Bain Capital 8 with Roman numerals that's based at the Cayman Islands and has lots of wonderful tax breaks available to those who funnel money through it. And so Bain Capital 8 is a $3.5 billion fund that includes Dunkin' Donuts, and it also includes CRC Health Group, which was a promising fast-growing drug treatment chain that, and this is pretty critical, had no wrongful death charges and no known preventable deaths or allegations facing it.
Until
Bain took it over.
Right. And do me a favor. Your piece is remarkable, and you tell the story very well. Tell the story of Brendan, the 14-year-old Asperger's syndrome patient that died in their custody.
Sure. And before doing so, I need to sort of put in a stipulation, which is kind of dry, which is that CRC has never been found liable or guilty in any civil or criminal court for any wrongdoing of any kind. So, for instance, this story was settled last year in a wrongful death suit, but quietly, no public judgments. So one of the points is, so here's this kid named Brendan Blum. He's 14 years old. He's a troubled, aggressive kid who had Asperger's syndrome. And his mother was desperate, and the kid was violent and, had been arrested a few times for attacking the family. So she's told to go to this fantastic program in Utah called Youth Care of Utah. And this program at that point, by this point in time when he was sent there in 07, CRC had bought a new division called Aspen Education. So it went from being just drug treatment to including troubled teen programs. So this was a troubled teen program, and what happened, so this boy who was, sometimes disruptive in temperament and was kind of disbelieved that he had problems, went on the afternoon of June 27th complaining to the medical staff, feels really upset in the stomach, and things are crawling around, and then ultimately... Basically, he wakes up, he's complaining of stomach pain, he defecates his pants, and they don't believe him. They don't think he has anything serious. They just give him water and Pepto-Bismol, and the staff doesn't...
Such a good actor, that kid. He pooped his pants, and he's just putting on a show.
That's right. And so they don't really believe he's that serious. Later, when it's really obvious that he's kind of ill, but they don't know what... The culture of the place was such that they felt they couldn't call 911. And that becomes a hallmark of many other problems that occur throughout the chain. So what happens is they never telephoned the on-call nurse like they were supposed to. They didn't feel they had the right and power and authority as $9.50 an hour, very low-paid workers, to call 911 themselves. And they call the supervisor. And, he doesn't answer the phone. So the next day, the kid is found dead, and they didn't even check on him in the morning.
Well, this is after they move him to what's called the purple room, which is like an isolation room for kids that are acting out.
Yeah, it's also used for other more benign purposes, but basically it was used, in a de facto way to segregate the kid. And then basically they checked in him over the night, he was howling and in agony, and then he fell asleep for a while, and then they left, and they left their shift at 7 in the morning, and they hadn't checked on him, and he's dead. So what it turns out is he had something known as a twisted bowel or a bowel infarction. It's sort of a twisted bowel that needs emergency surgery to prevent, fatal or very serious outcomes. And they never called any ambulances. And the key thing is I spoke to an employee who had worked there, and he told me, his name is Josh Randall, he said, they didn't trust our judgment in emergency
situations. If you're working for $9.50 an hour on the graveyard shift, you don't want to buck the system. So that's
sick.
Yes, that mindset of, so this issue of lower level people feeling that they cannot call 911 in emergency situations, that's one cultural element into the culture of the company.
Well, and they get to that point because, and you mentioned that there'd never been anything like this in this company's history before it was acquired by Bain. This is the type of thing that people like these vulture capitalists do, right? It's the equivalent of sending manufacturing jobs overseas. It's stripping down the artifice of control and all the different safeguards in an operation to save money.
Yeah, it's like that, except the one of the issues is that CRC, when it was just an adult drug treatment chain, primarily did not have any preventable deaths or scandal in its background. But when Aspen Education, which became a division of CRC, absolutely did have some lawsuits and some preventable deaths in its background when it was acquired by CRC and Bain late in 2006. And I have in the article a family therapist who goes to the medical, named Elizabeth Feldman, goes to the medical director of CRC in late in the fall of 2006 while the deal is pending, and she knows about abuses and problem and lays out all sorts of problems in the treatment, the quality of care, and at Youth Care of Utah. This is before Brendan dies, and warns him, please, you have to, you know, don't go through with it. This is problematic. And this medical director just says, well, I'm sure Bain Capital is doing his due diligence. Now, he's denied that he's made those comments, but he admits to meeting her. So they had a warning. The point is that, like with other Bain acquisitions, there was no concern for the human consequences of trying to maximize revenue, although the strategies used with CRC and Aspen Division are not the same as used in factories when they
acquire
thousands.
And you're right. Our investigations found previously unreported allegations of abuse and neglect in at least 10 CRC residential drug and teen care facilities across the country, including three I visited undercover in Utah and California. With rare exceptions, such incidents have largely escaped notice because the programs are, thanks to lax state regulations, largely unaccountable. Art, can you stick around? I want to talk to you about your undercover investigations.
Absolutely.
All right, this is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back with more on this story.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, more about the dark side of a Bain success story.
Thank God it's
Friday. That's right, it's Friday afternoon, filling in on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Frisch. I've been here Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. It's 20 after. It's been a delight being here. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Art Levine. He is the contributing editor to Washington Monthly and a contributor as well to Salon, The Nation, The Atlantic, and many other publications. We're talking about his piece in Salon right now that you must go and read at salon.com, titled The Dark Side of Bain Success. Art, thanks for sticking around.
Well, thanks very much. I also want to tell your listeners there's a short summary version of it at Huffington Post. It's also a place for you to easily leave comments and your views about these issues. And
absolutely.
And before we finish, I do want to mention his current ties to a fellow who owns another abusive residential teen chain, or at least allegedly so, is Mel Sembler, who's his Florida finance co-chair. But I'd be glad to tell you about my undercover visits, too.
Yeah, that's what fascinates me. In your piece, you talk about going undercover at some of these places in a few different states. What was that like?
Well, essentially what happened is that for months, eventually they relented and they allowed me and they gave me a kind of tour of one of their supposedly showcase facilities, with the initials SUS of the Carolinas, S-U-W-S, the Carolinas near Asheville. But before then, I had to go on my own and basically pretend to be relatives of loved ones who I was hoping to place at these facilities for treatment. And so one of the places I went to was, Youth Care of Utah. And there, you know, the person showed me around, and then she showed me around and I went through the, and she sort of with pride stood next to the, one of the isolation rooms and showed how she looked at people to make sure that they were, you know, being monitored appropriately when they're in an isolation room. And then she brought up on her own the death of Brendan Blum. I didn't ask her about it. I just wanted to see what sort of stuff they told me. And she said, among other things, well, you know, it was a really shock for all of us. And then she said, well, fortunately, the family is not, and her terms were, hard against us, meaning angry. And at that moment, there was this wrongful death lawsuit being settled. You know, well, she's telling me, well, they're not angry at us. And then she said something which is sort of this blithe response, well, these things happen. And that sort of attitude, like, these things happen, this is one of the elements that I found. And then I went to Island View undercover and pretended, Island View, which is near youth care, also in Utah, I basically, with Island View, I said I had a daughter I wanted to place, and in youth care, I said I had a son with Asperger's. So in Island View, I had learned from a woman named Colleen Davidson, who's quoted on the record, how they basically, and this is a widespread throughout the troubled teen industry, did not believe her when she said she was sick. This is one of the key issues. The whole mindset is these are troublemaking kids who were lying malefactors and probably near sociopaths. That is the mindset that governs it. In fact, when the GAO talked about this, Greg Kutz testified, he said the only way that these people are going to believe that a kid is telling the truth is when his heart stops or his pulse stops. You know, essentially, this was in testimony in 2007. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it a little bit, but that was the thrust of his comments. They don't believe them until they stop breathing or their pulse stops.
Well, at least the Romneys made a buck.
Yes, and we don't know how much, because essentially the amounts, if and when tax returns are ever fully revealed, we could figure out how much. So the company itself, CRC, has had uneven profits over the years. Some years they actually did not even make a profit during the crash, you know, post-crash, sort of in 2008, 2009. But the revenues have bounced back up, and they earn about $450 million in revenue. They serve 30,000 people daily, mostly opiate addicts, mostly at methadone clinics, which is their big revenue source. And they have 140 facilities around the country.
Well, I'm curious, when you were undercover, did you ask certain kinds of questions that might...
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
Something, you know, I'm thinking something along the lines of, what are the qualifications of the people that are here on night duty?
Yeah, well, I didn't ask that, but I did inquire, and they were reassuring me, like at Island View, that they were licensed and well qualified, although I've had some indications that I cannot confirm, I'm not saying definitive, that maybe some of the licensing claims are not accurate, but I cannot confirm that, and I'm not saying that for sure, but that's what I learned subsequently. But one of the things was I was real interested in asking them questions about what the alumni who felt victimized and abused there felt that way, and felt, you know, that it was psychologically torturous for them, and medical neglect allegations. I was asking questions along those lines. So essentially they confirmed in a their positive spin way what happened. So for instance, this woman, Colleen Davidson, spat up blood, begged to see a doctor, was very sick, and the nurse didn't bother, the in-house nurse didn't come by for a few hours, and because the blood had washed away, the nurse said, well, you know, there's no proof that it's true, so we're not going to call a doctor. And so when I asked about that kind of scenario to the admissions director, show me around, she said, well, you know, we'll send somebody over, but we've got to make sure, you know, that there's proof there, you know, essentially is what she was saying, that there's something there before they send them on and check at a hospital. And then I found, and then similarly, this woman, young woman, described isolation treatments and these vicious encounter therapies that were verbally vicious and counter therapies that were so horrifying that the young women she knew, where each of the people had to make up and attack each other, they were so reluctant to do it, they were choking themselves to not go to the therapy, and one girl put feces in her own eye so she would get sick.
Art,
and
it's absolutely amazing. You can find more from Art. Follow him on Twitter, ArtL7. I guess the only thing they didn't try was putting these patients in a dog carrier on the Romney's car. But like I said, at least the Romney's made a buck. Thanks a lot for joining us, Art.
Right. Thank you so much for having me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program filling in. I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, I'm joined by John Fugelsang, the actor, activist, and new current television host. Welcome back. It is the Tom Hartman Program filling in for Tom this afternoon. I'm Carl Frisch, here all afternoon. Website is carlfrisch.com. Check it out so we can stay connected on Twitter, Facebook, and email. Joining me now, my good friend, the actor, activist, and comedian, who we just learned this week will have a new primetime show coming to current television very soon, John Fugelsang. Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, Carl. What a pleasure. Great to be on the show.
Absolutely.
It's a pleasure as a fan of Tom to hear you do villain.
Thank you very much. So, congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
You are going to be having a new show on Current.
I will be, yes, coming this fall. I am very, very thrilled to be joining Current's primetime lineup, along with my friends Joy Behar and Stephanie Miller. It's very exciting.
Any idea what the format's going to be?
Well, it's we're working on that. We've only just made the announcement this Wednesday in L.A., so we haven't even begun hiring our people yet. But the show is going to, if I had to say what its focus was, you know, it'll cover news, of course, and politics mainly, with a healthy dose of pop culture and science and tech. And whereas Governor Spitzer's excellent show, Viewpoint, on Current, goes after Wall Street crime, and Governor Granholm's show, The War Room, is all about, you know, Democratic politics. I think this show, you can look for this show having a special focus on the hypocrisy of the Christian right.
Oh, excellent.
That's sort of my stock and trade.
So they're giving you 4 hours a night?
5 hours a week, and that'll be a good start.
Well, that's certainly good. And then I also read that the Sexy Liberal Tour documentary is going to be coming out this September.
Very excited about that. That's going to feature, of course, Stephanie Miller and myself and Hal Sparks and Aisha Tyler. That was filmed in Boston and partially filmed in Madison, Wisconsin. And it's a little doc about Steph and about this tour and how we put it together. And you know, the greatest thing about the Sexy Liberal Tour, for your listeners who don't know, this was a show that we did like a one-off show in early 2010 in New York City, Stephanie, Hal, and I. And then I sort of tricked her into making it a nationwide comedy tour, and I brought my old theater agent from when I was off-Broadway on to be our booker and tour manager. And it wound up, you know, being really one of the most successful political comedy tours ever. We grossed $1 million the first year, and we're up for four Pollstar nominations. We had, you know, celebrities joining us on stage and in the
number
audience.
One on iTunes and Billboard, and
that's the big one. Yeah, we were the first political comedy record to ever hit number one on the Amazon, iTunes, and Billboard comedy charts. That was during Christmas week, Carl, for an album with the name Liberal in the title, with no major label support. So when they say that liberals are like a marginalized minority, don't believe it. We were able to bring an album to number one.
There wasn't even a physical product out to sell in a store at that point.
Exactly.
So it was competing with everybody else. I'm interested, you know, many people may not know that you are the guy that, through no fault of your own, you just asked a pretty straightforward question of Mitt Romney's spokesman, Eric Fernstrom. You asked him how he's going to be able to go back to the middle, and it got probably one of the biggest gaffes of the election cycle, when Fernstrom said that they'll just kind of etch-a-sketch things.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's always I've always heard the expression, it's only a political gaffe when someone tells the truth. And,
yeah.
And that was the first of two times that happened for Mr. Fernstrom, who seems like a really nice guy. A little background, I was doing mornings on Soledad O'Brien's show on CNN for a few months, and you know, Mr. Fernstrom was on, and Soledad turned to me, and she kind of gave me the nod that, you want to ask a question? And I was excited because I knew exactly what I wanted to ask. And it was at the height of, you know, and the soul of God would let me ask a question because I'm just a humble clown. But this is at the height of the apex of the GOP primary race when you had Santorum and Gingrich in a three-man race, both assailing Governor Romney for not being conservative enough. And
right.
I wanted to ask, you know, isn't the problem that he's too conservative? And I phrased it with a lot of journalistic speak by just saying, you know, Governor Romney is up against a field now that's considerably less moderate than Senator McCain was. And given the fact that Santorum and Gingrich have forced the governor to tack so far to the right, isn't there a concern about him reaching out to independents and moderates in the general election? Which is my very wordy way of saying, your guy's too conservative.
Right.
And Mr. Fernstrom said, oh, no, it's like a reset button. You hit the Etch-A-Sketch. It's like an Etch-A-Sketch.
And do you think that they're actually going to hit the Etch-A-Sketch any time? Because it doesn't seem like he's changed much since
no,
the primaries.
No, he backed himself into a corner. After that, he really couldn't. And that's why it was newsworthy, Carl. I didn't think anything of it. I was shocked he said it. I knew that there was no time for me to ask a follow-up question. And like many of your listeners, I've just gotten kind of numb to Governor Romney lying and the media just turning a blind eye to it.
Right.
I mean, the lies this guy has told, I empathize with any listeners who want to see President Obama grab him by the lapels and say, listen, man, I have never apologized for America. We are not attacking Wall Street, and Joseph Smith's story doesn't check out.
Well,
I didn't expect much of anything. I get in the car to go home, and I look on my phone on Twitter, and I see Etch-A-Sketch as the number one trending topic in the country. And it took me a few minutes to put it together. By that night, that clip was airing on every news channel. I had just brought my newborn baby home from the hospital 4 days earlier, so I hadn't slept in like a week, and I looked like Skeletor, and it was the most viewed thing I had done in ages. And I still get right-wing hate mail for it.
Did your new baby get an Etch-A-Sketch for a home present?
No, but I'll tell you the truth, Carl. Almost every show I've done on the road since then, someone has asked me to sign an Etch-A-Sketch.
Well, you should actually be contracted by, I don't know who makes
Ohio
the
Ohio Art.
Ohio Art should be paying you a percentage of their business.
Well, their stock went up that night, and sales of Etch-A-Sketch went up over 1,000% on Amazon.com that night. The original iPad. And so it's nice for me, I guess, to be a tiny, insignificant historical footnote in a very dispiriting presidential
and helping the economy here at home.
I'm proud to be a part, doing my part.
But, so what did you make of Mitt Romney's no good, very bad week?
Oh, well, it was amazing to watch. You know, like I said, Governor Romney's been going around saying that, falsely claiming that President Obama has been apologizing around the world for America, and now America has to go around the world apologizing for Mitt Romney.
Yeah, I think he was trying to give the president a reason to go abroad and apologize for something.
I think he was trying to get the topic of conversation off his tax records.
Yeah.
And why he won't reveal them. I, for one, want to see the man's worth certificate. I'm a worther. then, of course, he went overseas, failed at that, and as soon as he gets home, Harry reads at him again. First, he's in London, and insulting the people of London. And I got to say something, Carl. Mitt Romney was over in London with a huge staff of advisors and help, and he didn't build these gaffes on his own, okay? He had help.
I don't
someone
even think
helped
he...
him. Someone made his schedule. Someone cleared him to go out without a prompter. He didn't build those gaffes by himself.
I don't even think he went there for this trip, that we ended up seeing. I think the only reason the Romneys went to London at the time that they did go to London, because they could have gone any time this summer before the convention, was so that they'd have something to distract people while their horse is competing in the Olympics.
Well, and you know what? I think it's fantastic. If you can teach your horse how to do electric slide, you deserve some kind of medal. That's wonderful. And, he should be very proud for having a horse that can dance the frug or whatever.
Everything, the horse did not do it alone. They did spend a big chunk of change on a sports psychologist for their horse. I'm not even kidding.
You know what? Barack Obama, by the way, never said in that speech, which was ripping off Elizabeth Warren, we should add.
Right.
But he never said that government built those things. He said society did it. And
right.
Guess what? Mitt Romney had a $77,000 tax write-off for his horse. We know that from the 1 year of returns he's allowed us to see.
The partial
so
year of returns.
Help. We paid for his horse.
Right.
And I'd be much more impressed, to be honest, by dressage monkeys. They got some chimps out there to do that, and then I'll tune in. But you're right. He offends our British allies deeply. He became a laughingstock in a matter of days. Then, I was terrified he was going to go to Israel and say that the Wailing Wall was Meshuggah.
He made, there are debutantes that have tried every which way they can to get ridiculed on the tabloids in England. And he managed to do it in a matter of hours.
He really did. And he really made a laughingstock out of himself. And this is why Mr. Murdoch was going on Twitter saying that Romney's got to start firing some of his advisors. Then he goes over to Israel and, you know, talks about their great healthcare system and their mandate. And yes, Israel does have a mandate, Carl. The mandate is, which of these four free plans are you going to pick?
Right.
That's our socialist healthcare ally, Israel, with Bibi Netanyahu, who just raised taxes on the wealthiest Israelites. So, you know, Israelis. So it's so there you go. I mean, it's just, you know, and then the stuff he said about Palestine, really, really ignorant. And then he goes over to Poland because who do they want more in Poland than a, you know, pro-management, anti-labor, anti-union guy at Lech Walesa's backyard?
Right.
So, you know, I think he really was hoping that it would make him seem presidential and statesmanlike. And really the only race now is how much can the media make it seem like there really is a race. The greatest concern is that, you know, Democrats or liberals who are discouraged with this president will sit out the election because they think Obama's going to have an easy, you know, Clinton versus Dole romp. And in reality, it's more important than ever this year to get out, even if you don't care about president who's president, because in 2012, state and local elections
right.
matter so much more
Absolutely.
Than who's in the White House. And who's in the White House matters a lot.
Well, in 2016, we're going to be
171 years old.
We're going to be rebuilding that bench, you know, after the president's reelected. And I would say that, you know, the president is likely going to win. But I never forget that this is a country that, you know, elected George W. Bush 1.5 times.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of these voter ID laws and all these voter suppression tactics, there could be millions of people that voted last time that won't be able to vote this time. And if those laws were not on the books, I would be confident that the president would be reelected 100%. But that's why we have to be diligent. Can you stick around for the next segment?
Love to. Thank you.
All righty. We're chatting with John Fugelsang. He is the actor, activist, and comedian who we just learned this week is going to have a show on current television this fall. We're chatting about 2012 and getting some of his humorous insights. This is the Tom Hartman Program all afternoon. It's 45 after. Filling in, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. And you can get more about John Fugelsang at his website, johnfugelsang.com, and follow him on Twitter at John Fugelsang. This is the Tom Hartman Show, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of the funny stuff that just happens in every campaign with John Fugelsang.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. It has been a delight. I'm Carl Frisch with you here on Wednesday, Thursday, and today, Friday afternoon. Joining me, we've been chatting with John Fugelsang, one of the comedians doing the Sexy Liberal Tour with Stephanie Miller. He's also an actor and the new host of a current television program that will be coming to you this fall. John, thanks for sticking around.
Thank you, Carl. May I make an announcement about the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour?
You sure can.
Today's a big day. The tour's been going on for, like I said, like a year and a half. We just had a huge show at the Pantages Theater in L.A. last weekend. Hal Sparks and Stephanie and I had Lily Tomlin and Rob Reiner join us on stage for that one. But today we announced and tickets went on sale for our first ever New York City date.
That's great.
At the Beacon Theater on October 27th, right before Election Day, we'll be joined by Aisha Tyler and some very special surprise celebrity guests. It's going to be a really, really great fun, and it's our only New York date for the show. So,
and people can get tickets at Ticketmaster.com and also at SexyLiberal.com.
They sure can, yeah. So please check it out and come on down. It's going to be just the biggest pre-election day.
Well, for folks out there listening that have not been to a Sexy Liberal event, I got to tell you, I've been to two, one in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and one in Boston, and they are a blast. It's good to be around a bunch of laughing liberals.
Yeah, it really is. It's nice to remember that you're not totally insane. And, you know, no one sets out to be a liberal. No one sets out to say, like, hey, I'm going to adopt a set of morally advanced positions that will make my neighbor with the bald eagle fetish question my patriotism. But you know how it is, man. Sometimes you wake up and you say, oh, my God, I'm smart, I'm moral. I'd rather my tax dollars help people here than blow them up over there. And my taste in music doesn't totally suck. I'm a liberal. So this show is for you.
Speaking of bad music, the Republican convention's coming up in August. In Tampa. I can't think of anything worse than Tampa in August with Mitt Romney.
Oh, Manhattan in August with anybody is pretty awful, trust me.
So, you know, the Democrats will likely have any performer they could possibly want at their convention, and the Republicans will have a bunch of barbershop quartets, no doubt. The spectacle of these conventions, what do you make of them?
Well, look, at this convention, you're not going to see George Bush. You're not going to see Dick Cheney. You're not going to see Rush Limbaugh. So if Mitt Romney stays home, it'll be just like Vietnam in the 60s. you know, they're pep rallies, and the GOP's in a tough place now because they've never – I don't think they've ever had a nominee with less enthusiasm amongst the base. And if there was ever a ripe time for a third-party evangelical challenge this the year, I think it's a bit too late in the game.
Right.
But, I mean, my Republican friends and loved ones and family members who spent all the primary season just hating Romney – and now a lot of them are probably gonna go for him. And I keep saying, well, you Ron Paul people, you know, why aren't you going for Gary Johnson then? And they're not. They're gonna go and stay with a tribe. I've come to believe libertarian is a Latin term meaning embarrassed Republican.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also somebody who thinks that they're just smarter than you because they claim that they're more conservative on economics than liberals and more socially liberal on social issues than conservatives, so that makes them better than everybody, and it's what makes them so great to talk to.
In many senses, they are. Look, Ron Paul is fearless on the drug war, and I admire him tremendously. He's fearless on the Iraq war. He is one of the few people in all of Congress.
But he's also afraid of black people.
Well, those newsletters are disgusting. Those newsletters guarantee he will never, ever be president. The very fact that he would appear and speak in front of a Confederate flag is pretty disgusting. And I think his comments about, you know, wanting to get rid of the Americans with Disabilities Act is much worse than his comments about the Civil Rights Act. I think the Americans with Disabilities Act is the one thing government has done in my lifetime that's made me most proud of my society. So, you know, it's pathetic. But Ron Paul, again, you know, his sane half is one of the finest politicians I've ever seen. But the guy is one Gotham City acid spill away from being Harvey Dent.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of look at him like Jesus. I like some of his teachings, but a lot of his followers frighten me.
Well, but again, you know, I like all of Jesus. I like most of Jesus's teachings. Half of Ron Paul is just... I mean, come on, I would vote for him to be like the mayor of Deadwood, you know, like lawless Old West cattle baron, he has my vote. But for every sane thing he says, and again, he's a real conservative, and you'll see how many areas where he and Kucinich line up with the real liberal and the real conservative.
Sure.
So I have a lot of respect for him, but I'll tell you, his son went and endorsed Mitt Romney, which upset a lot of libertarians I know, and I talked to my friends and cousins who were all pro-Ron Paul for months and months. They're not going to go vote for Gary Johnson, which I don't understand at all.
It's the polling, you know, it's not just an enthusiasm problem with Republicans. Polling out this week from Pew indicates that Mitt Romney might be the, he's reached Palin levels of unpopularity.
Yeah, and it's only going to happen more. I mean, you know, if Barack Obama's campaign was worried about getting young people back into the fold and getting, you know, minorities and first-time voters and folks who, you know, showed up to vote for Obama for the first time in their life, let me tell you something. Mitt Romney will get more people to vote for Obama than any catchy Will.i.am jingle on his best day.
It's the truth. It's the truth. And I suppose he's not able to bring in the young people when asked about college tuition, and he suggests – you should see what the best rates are and maybe ask your parents for some cash.
It's really awful. And again, his whole record, I mean, how can you call yourself a conservative and not be disgusted by Romney's record? And the worst part about it is everything in Romney's record he should be proud of is that which he has run away from. And if Mitt Romney would put his foot down and stop sucking up to the Tea Party base and say, yeah, we had a mandate in my state, and you know what, damn it, it saved people's lives.
I thought
and
the,
yes,
exactly the speech
what Obamacare is. It's the same thing I did.
Exactly.
It's not a tax. It's a penalty. If you don't like it, you can suck it. We saved American lives, and that makes me a patriot. Conservatives who didn't agree with him would respect him.
And independents would flock to him. I thought the NAACP peace speech was a perfect opportunity for his own sister soldier moment where he could criticize these voter ID laws and everything else. And, of course, he can't take the – he would never do that.
He would never do it. And the voter ID laws are actually interesting because I think they're really a true sign of how scared the Republican Party is. You know, the GOP establishment looks at the demographics and they see – that right-wing white males who drive trucks and have impacted colon.
And nothing frightens them more. John Fuglesang, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Carl. You do a great
show. Absolutely. Thank you. That was John Fuglesang. More about him at johnfuglesang.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's been a delight filling in for Tom. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We've had a lot of great guests, and I really appreciate everybody joining us and all the great calls as well. If you want to stay connected with me, you can go to carlfrisch.com. It's my website where you can find ways to connect with me on Twitter and Facebook and every other way. So stick around and stay in touch.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.